overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center of Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week. Have a beautiful week.
With a gentle mindfulness bell, we find ourselves stopping and opening at the same time, opening to this field of love in which we meet, an energetic field of spirit. And we remember that we're spiritual beings and we're having a human experience at the same time. And so you could say we're bi-spiritual. We have a spiritual side and we have a human side. And they meet in the breath of the one life. And the more we enter into mindful awareness, we can smile and say, I have arrived, I am home. I was reading Albert Einstein this weekend. And he talked about seeing the universe as a friendly place. Could we see this as a user-friendly universe? That everything is here for us. Not that it's a place that we have to arm ourselves against and find other to oppose forces of good and evil. He says that's a universe that's divided against itself. And Einstein said you'd probably need a wrathful God to bring down his wrath on a universe where there's sin and corruption. And he says we need a different kind of God. A God that knows the universe is a friendly place. And that in fact, we're made out of star stuff. The earth and the stars are all part of what we are. And so we begin to expand the field of awareness from the local mind into the non-local mind, the mind of the universe. Wednesday night after satsang, I found myself turning on public broadcasting, David Attenborough, this ancient wise soul, was doing a series on the green planet and the wisdom and the intelligence within the rainforests, within the coral reefs. It blows your mind to know that there is this intelligence within our planet that is so far beyond the local mind with its conclusions and its belief systems. Imagine an intelligence that doesn't think thoughts, the intelligence of fungi and bacteria. And after I'm blown away by watching David Attenborough, then Nova talks about the wisdom of the galaxies and how there was a cosmic web in the universe made out of helium and hydrogen. And through the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago, supernova stars then gave birth to the galaxies. And I'm sitting here blown away with the intelligence of the universe. And knowing that we're made out of that, that we're made out of light. We're made out of spirit. And so this Sunday morning, we're going to explore this web of knowing, this web of intelligence that abides within all creation. But we can't know it externally. It has to be an internal switch that goes on. In our revealing service, beloved Seamus reminded us that there's the voice in the head of the committee and the world that would have us believe what they tell us. But underneath all those voices and all that noise in the head, there is that still small voice. There is that guidance system. There is that web of knowing that is available to all of us through lowly listening. And the key is that it arrives in the silence. And so on this Sunday morning, I invite you to touch that silence, which is the language of God, knowing that the silence doesn't get louder, but it gets clearer when the voices subside. And so when you're ready to play in the playground of the unmanifest with me, I invite you to open your eyes, open your heart, open your mind. And I see these familiar faces, it's so nice. And this lovely little angel, I'm responsible for her because I married her mommy and daddy. And you're the consequence of that. Yes, you are. She's playing with my penguin. And there you go. So this month of July, I'm exploring the idea of more together than alone. It's basically how we need each other in life. And it's taken from a class that I taught by Mark Nepo, who says at this time on the planet, we need to come together in order to serve something greater than the individual self. We have a country that's predicated on the individual and, you know, me and me being a success and the achieving and what we can get, but it's not about me. My favorite little Zen saying that really irritates people, that's why I love to say it, is 99.9% of the things you talk about are all about you and you're not. But when I say you're not, that means the idea of you is a dream. It's a construct of the mind. And when that construct begins to fall away, well, then the question is, who am I? And then you begin to discover that you are part of this something, this infinite mind that Ernest Holmes speaks about. The one mind, the one consciousness, and it begins to wake up within its creation. And so, yes, we have the creation. Yes, we have the finite self, but we're accessing it from a higher plane of awareness. Let's call it love, because that's a wonderful word. Find a love that is universal, that doesn't want to attach and possess and manipulate. Rumi says, what you think of love are but subtle degrees of domination and servitude. He says, but true love comes fully formed like the moonlight in the window. Now, you can ponder that and meditate on that for as long as you want. And what does true love look like? It's like the moonlight that's fully formed. Now, could we play with something so vast, so impersonal as that, and not be into the manipulation and domination and servitude that so many of us think is what really relationships are all about? They're not. And then you realize love is here to set you free. Love is not here to bind you or control you. And then, well, gosh, and if God is love, and if we are an aspect of that, well, then what we are is love. And love doesn't possess or bind. Love doesn't control or manipulate. What does love do? Love plays. Love reveals itself. Love celebrates the moment. And it doesn't see itself as different. There is a fuzzy penguin who's made out of love, playing with a little girl who's made out of love, and I venture to say they're not separate. And so what if we could play in that realm of this web of love, this web of peace, this web of knowing that is always there? And you know, when people say, I don't have a clue, good, you're not supposed to have a clue. Could we be comfortable with the uncertainty of life? It was Emerson that says, we all seek to be certain, but only to the degree that you are uncertain is there any hope for you. Well, when we're certain, we're in the dead zone. Got it all figured out. Might as well write my obituary. But if you're in the uncertain place, well, you know, I've been talking to my friends, my progressive spiritual friends, about is there hope for the planet at this stage? Because things seem to be contracting, especially around the evangelical movement and their thoughts around women and gays and so forth, contraception. And it feels like we're going backwards in time. And my beloved friend Carol Karn says, this is how breakthroughs happen. There has to be a death in order for there to be a birth. And we all know those patterns throughout creation. There is an order, then there is a flaming disorder, and we have disorder right now. And then the hope is that there will be a reordering in a more expansive, loving, playful way. Are you going to bring my little penguin back to me? Thank you. I'll put him up here so everybody can see it. This is my spirit animal. Jody is visiting her grandson in Colorado Springs, and this morning she sent me a photograph of three penguins. She must be at a zoo or somewhere. And then she sends a little comment. The two in the back are together.
Well, you mean we're monogamous kind of creatures? Well, I think so. You know, when we have the baby, we both sit on the egg. She sits on it, I sit on it, and then we take care of it. Well, are you a superior species or an inferior? Well, they call me the emperor penguin for a reason, don't they?
You know, when I studied with the shamans, they would take you on these journeys. They would beat the drums. This is very indigenous. And then they would take you to the lower world. It's all a metaphor. There's the upper world, the lower world, the inner world. And anyway, you just go along. They're beating the drum. And you're supposed to call forth your spirit animal. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, because the mind gets in the way. I'm thinking an antelope, a lion, a leopard, something exotic, maybe a giraffe. And out from the comes waddling was a penguin. And I thought, it can't be. And then you're instructed under this hypnotic place to ask your spirit animal any questions that you might have. And I said to the spirit animal, the penguin, how are we going to create peace on Earth? And you know what the penguin showed me? How everybody's taking care of everybody else's little penguin on the Antarctic. And then, and I said, is there any hope? And then they're all sliding and they're playing and they're in the water. And he's showing me by his example, this is the way we can change the world. By learning to get along together, by playing with each other, and by tending each other's children, that they're all our children. So a silly little process going within brought forth a penguin into my consciousness who's been my companion ever since.
Well, that sounds kind of crazy, David.
And I said, I know, isn't that wonderful to be a little bit crazy? My teacher, Llewellyn, says you have to have a screw loose if you really want to connect to the universe. You can't be so tightly wound that you can't imagine. You know, imagine that we're part of the great mystery of the universe, that we're part of the cosmos, that we're part of the intelligence that's within nature. And it is hugely vast and way beyond what we are with our belief systems. So imagine no belief system. I wonder if you can. Last week, I started this series by speaking about my favorite thing in the whole world, and that is just to live in the question. The mind is 10 times more active when you're living in the question, how then shall we live, Paula, knowing that we don't have the house on the lake anymore? And then instead of giving you an answer, and the Talmud says, why destroy a beautiful question with a silly answer? Don't settle for an answer. Live in the question, because the questions trigger things. How are we going to learn to get along as a species? How are we going to respect women and gays? I was sharing with them, Trey found this gem of a thing on Netflix, and it was called The Closet Monster, and we started watching it last night, and it was so painful to see how gay people have been oppressed and how it makes a monster out of you until you can love that child and accept them as they're growing up. So we're going to finish watching that painful movie, and hopefully that part of us that was closeted and had to live in fear for so many years, being told you were illegal, you were an abomination, that he could be loved and accepted and healed at a deeper level. So what if we all get that opportunity at some level to say, what is it going to take for me to heal my stuff? In this lovely book, Things That Join the Sea and Sky, Mark Nepo does a tribute to the question. When he goes all the way to India to study with this master teacher, and she says, the teacher says to him, you've come a long way to meet yourself. And then she talks about the necessity of opening to the questions in life because they're the doorways to your liberation. And so here's what she says. Life unravels the urge to look for answers. Instead, we're asked to think of questions. They become our teachers, and we learn to walk with the questions. So every Sunday, every class that I teach, I'm living with the question, how can I best serve the emergence of this divine love at the Center for Spiritual Living here? It's not by going back and doing the same old thing that we've always done. Because if you've always done what you've always done, you will always get what you've always gotten. What if we need a new way of approaching all of this? And that's where the question can help. So she says, so what would you like to ask today that I can't answer? Bless you, Sylvia. Why ask questions at all? And her response to him was, much of my life has been devoted to staying in a conversation with the mystery. And as I get older, and we're all getting older, I long for the courage to stay in conversation with those who've suffered and given of themselves to keep life going. I loved what Nancy said in the revealing service. She's gotten to a stage in life where the elder is flowering within her. And in the elder consciousness, you see the grace of life. You see the freedom of life, where once you were bound, you see it's now really taking me into a whole different way of approaching it. You're not a victim anymore. So here's Katoot. Her name is Katoot. She says, why do we have to keep circling back on what we already know? And her response to that was, because all knowledge is provisional, a snapshot of the flow of life, which never stops. And like this river, life keeps shifting as we huddle over and over again in our fixed picture. So knowledge must be continually revisited. That's why we ask the questions. And the life of questions is the one art in life that will never fail. You know, it's a different question today than it was when you were 20, than it was when you're 30. You know, what is important to you now? A young lady was sharing that she saw a financial planner who said, if you keep doing everything in the next 20 years, and she said, it would kill me to do the same thing for the next 20 years. And so she said, I can't go down the path that I've always gone down. Maybe it's time for a radical change. Now, could the question be that radical change? What is needed at this time in my life? Is it a new puppy? Is it a, or not? You know, we have the old pug and he's getting fragiler and fragiler every day. I don't think that's a word. Is it Tia fragiler? More fragile. And someone, they always say, are you going to get another one? Are you going to get another one? I said, I got my hands full with this one. This one is, you know, he's a real challenge, and it's so sacred to go through the end times with him. This is the anniversary of beloved Bert's death. It was a year ago that my old white dog died, and now I got the little black dog. And it's so funny because Humphrey is sleeping in the hole in the carpet that Bert dug in the dining room. You know, Bert would scratch away, dug a hole to China, but it was right in the middle of the dining room. And we didn't have the heart to get rid of Bert's hole, so we covered it with an area rug. Well, now the pug lies in Bert's hole as if Bert is there. And I think it's so appropriate. So she goes on to say, eventually you will go home and realize your struggle is always with yourself. And when you do, don't feel bad about that tonight. The only one we can change really is ourselves. All the work we get to do is on ourselves. So where am I blocked at this stage of life? You know, where am I blocked to that love? Where am I blocked to that freedom? Where am I blocked to the peace that is my inherent nature? Where am I blocked to this creative voice of the one that moves me forward instead of listening to the critical voice of the one that seems to contract and get triggered? Could we ask the essential question that will set us free? Huh. And at the very end, she says this. The last thing that Katoot offered was questions, she said, are your doorways to your liberation. She started to walk away and she turned around and then she concluded this. You must ask a question as if you were opening a door that you would like to walk through with another. And then she added, at least that has worked for me. Questions have become the windows and the doorways that have moved me in a new direction in life. So then we come here to be teachable, to enter into the beginner's mind and the beginner's heart. As I was exploring this idea of the web of life and this web of knowing, I started reflecting on that gnosis that Jesus spoke about in the Gnostic Gospels. Gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, Gnostic. The Gnostic Gospels are what the teacher knows. They're the sayings of the teacher. Adam said he's reading a book, but they're just the sayings of the master teacher. The Jefferson Bible is that way. Thomas Jefferson just put the sayings that the Gospels had of the master teacher Jesus, and none of the hearsay. And so you get a whole different approach to spirituality. When I taught the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas here, one of my favorite ones, it says, these are the logians, which are the sayings of the master. And the master said, and the master said, like the master Jesus said, one of his last lines was, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So whenever we want to get caught up in judgment, people are acting crazy out there, you can just coin that phrase, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And then ignorance is temporary and stupid is forever. And you can give a little chortle with that. And we're not here to change the world. We're here to really change the way we see the world. And so Jesus would say things like, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. In other words, you've seen Brahman, The Atman and the Brahman are one. Atman is the soul. Brahman is the infinite creator of the universe. And our soul and Brahman are one. Jesus said it in a different way. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Don't make me special. That's the warning. He said, what I do, you too shall do, and greater. So he was pointing us to this potential that we have to discover this Christ energy that's within us. And so then you'll pick up the Gnostic Gospels, and Jesus would say in there, the Master says, if you liberate that which is within you will save you. Hear this one, Seamus, but if you do not liberate that which is within you will destroy you. That's a kind of a harsh phrase to you. Wow. In other words, there's an imperative that we listen to this knowing that comes, this gnosis that comes from within. It's not something that your parents give you, you know. It's not something that society gives you. You don't get it in college or in your well-meaning attempts to achieve some kind of specialness on the planet. You get to this gnosis by surrendering, by deeply listening, by admitting that you don't know. It was Emerson that said, and so many of the teachers point to the truth. Emerson said, be and not seem. He says, let us acquiesce. Let's open to the sacredness of this moment, to the awareness that's flowing. And he says, get our bloated nothingness out of the way, which is the me person that thinks he's got all the answers. And in that, you connect what he calls the divine circuits. I'm calling it the web of knowing. To connect with the divine circuits. Well, then when it starts to reveal itself, it's going to reveal itself in images. Not necessarily in words. You know, there's a book that I ordered. It's called More Than True by Robert Bly. And I'm thinking of teaching it, but it's very psychological. And it's the wisdom of fairy tales, Tia. And it's six ancient fairy tales that speak a language that cannot be understood with the logical mind. Because it's all metaphor. It's all myth. When we taught the power of myth, Joseph Campbell said, a myth is something that never happened but is always happening. And so the myth of the virgin birth is something that happens within us. We give birth to our own Christ child, if you will, through the Mary, through the purity of our being. The myth of the resurrection is that we have to die, be crucified to an old false sense of self, and then this emerging something arises. And you see it as a sacred pattern through the images of fairy tales, through myths, because the knowing comes through. Jesus said, I speak, but they do not understand. So he taught in parable. In fact, there's a book called The Wisdom of the Parables, and I was told, if you want to teach the Bible or Jesus, this is all you need are the parables, because they're all stories. They're teaching stories. A man went out, and he was sowing seed, and he cast it aside, and some landed on the side and burned up with the sun. Some the birds ate, and some actually took root and barely survived, and a few, you know, and those seeds are like seed thoughts, the divine planting seeds. What's going to grow in your consciousness? What's going to grow in the garden of your soul? So he used that as a metaphor. It's the metaphor of the soil. How teachable are you? How receptive are you? When a greater idea wants to grow within your being, are you a space in which that can happen? Or you have so many conclusions that you're not teachable? So this is the beauty of metaphor, of story, because the knowing can come through all of that. Let's see, what did I inspire? The Gnostic Gospels. Oh, there was a book in the bookstore, and I didn't know it was there. It was called Gardeners of the Garden. And I'm a gardener, silly, so I took it home, and I thought I'd read it. And it was about a woman who does past life readings for people. And usually, you know, we've had many incarnations, if you believe in reincarnation. And in this book, she was doing a past life recall for this young man. And the past life that he recalled was being an extraterrestrial on another planet, I think in the Pleiades. And so she had this extraterrestrial under hypnosis talking about his past life. And what he revealed was that the extraterrestrials have been on planet Earth, and they are the gardeners, and we humans are the garden. And what they're trying to do in this advanced sense of knowing is to expand the human consciousness to a galactic realization that we're all one. Does this not sound like Ernest Holmes? Maybe he was from an outer space person. They talk about oneness. And on his planet, through hypnosis, she revealed that all communication is telepathic, and there are no separate selves that want to acquire for themselves. Everybody works for the greater good of all. That they're all part of the collective wholeness. So anything that is done on their planet is to serve the whole, not the individual. And he says they're hoping through their presence on planet Earth that they can help the human species relate more from oneness, from our interconnectedness, or what Thich Nhat Hanh would call our inner beingness. And it makes you wonder, was Thich Nhat Hanh one of those people from outer space that came to raise consciousness? Because they're all saying the same thing, that we are part of an intelligent universe that is a friendly universe, and it is here for us. So instead of thinking of him as an alien who's coming here to dominate us, because that's then you need the old wrathful God to punish the aliens, what if they came here to help us humans wake up to our divinity? It was in the bookstore, Judy. I don't know how it got there. It was obviously there for me to read. So what if the universe is pointing us in a different direction all the time? I noticed in the bookstore over there, there's the book called The We Consciousness that Wanda Gale Campbell sent to me. She said, you might want to teach this. It's 33 ways to build the consciousness of oneness. And it too is a channeled work from a woman. The day that Wayne Dyer passed, he started coming through to her. And so you could say it's a channel work from Wayne, but Wayne doesn't take credit for it. In the book, he said it's the we consciousness that is speaking. It's that same level of awareness where we're part of a collective whole, the mind of God, let's call it, the mind of God. And it's saying we have to learn that we're more together than we are alone, and to start playing in that realm of our oneness. Then if you're like Serena and you go to Thailand, an elephant named Satik hands her a treasure from the ground, and the person says, I can't believe the elephant and a female. And you know, she'd been asking me to pray for the right and perfect mate. So I said, maybe that was the right and perfect mate. And Serena laughed and we both nodded our heads. It comes in whatever form it comes. This interconnectedness, this love. It's not bound by species, you know. And then you find yourself relating to squirrels and birds and worms and insects and butterflies and puppy dogs and kitty cats. And they're all part of that one life. And sometimes it's harder to do the human-on-human relationship because, by and large, most humans are stuck in their individualized pain body. But when we can allow ourselves to just expand into that knowing by getting our bloated nothingness out of the way, we begin to experience this field of belonging. I thought I would redeem my wisdom on the garden. The gardener of the gardens was the extraterrestrials. And this was a little book that was sent to me from England. And it's one of the most inspirational number one books in Spain. And it's a little book. Again, it's all a metaphor. It's a story of a gardener in his garden and the different experiences that he has and how he's teaching us that the garden is speaking its language, the pine trees, the birds, everything is this knowing, awakening within the gardener. And the gardener becomes very wise because he's become one with the very thing that he's been serving. And this is just a font of wealth. And there's a little section called The Transformation. And he tells the story of a young man with splendid ideas who often asked the gardener for his advice, went to him on a rainy day, and he said, I've been observing the world around me. And it's kind of like the world we're looking at today. I still wear this uniform for Ukraine. They're still at war over there. Say a prayer. He says, I've observed the world around me, and I've found other things that tear my soul and make me sad. I've seen the world with injustice, lack of kindness. I have a sense of hopelessness in the eye of the poor and the ill. I've seen the claws and greed clutch into the hearts. I've seen the clouds of hate forming on our planet. So he's a disturbed young man, and he's witnessing the suffering on the planet. Could we be present when the suffering presents itself to us and not turn a blind eye, not affirm, oh, there's nothing wrong. No, it's coming to be met, to be seen like a crying child. So the young man is asking the gardener for his wisdom. He says, and I think I'd like to change the world. So how can I do that? I'm going to change the world. Karen Drucker has a song, One Heart at a Time. So he's asking the question, stay in the question. And he says, what can one individual do against so much grief and so much devastation on the planet? And in a state of despair and hopelessness, the young man fell silent, and he put his face in between his hands, asking a question, not really expecting an answer. And then the gardener, after a period of time, gently says to him, you can change the world, in a very soft tone. How can one man change the world? Says the young man. And he says, I don't understand. If only one man changes, how can mankind change? And here's what the gardener said. Each human being is the entire human race. His image shooting towards the ardent depths of the cosmos, said the gardener, looking into the fire of creation. And when a human being submerges himself into the ocean of light, with capital letters, because what we are light beings, and I was sharing with Adam, my teacher Llewellyn von Lee wrote a book called The Alchemy of Light, and it's how to work with that light. Gardner's saying the same thing, nor all and nor, light upon light. So could we be teachable enough to say, well, what do you mean? He's telling me I'm a light being? When a human being submerges himself in an ocean of light, then all human beings are caught by the brilliance of his radiance.
Well, you just mean I need to turn the light on and let my light shine to you? That's enough? Whoa.
The gardener's telling me that? That doesn't make sense. I don't understand, says the young man. He says, you don't have to understand. Birds don't understand the mechanics of flight, and yet the birds, they fly. It is as natural for the birds to fly as it is for a human being to attain love, the gardener says. And he says, and what must I do to change myself? He says, not try to change yourself. Not try to change myself, and that's going to change me, Sylvia? And so he's looking puzzled. He doesn't know what to do. And then he says, if you don't try, you won't achieve it, continues the gardener. So you have to wish for the change within yourself and be open so that the transformation takes place inside you. All you have to do is to be willing to have the shift inside, to begin to see things as light, to see things through the eyes of love, to see things as your own self, Shannon. It's not separate. And then something alchemical starts to happen. It's the alchemy of the light working within us. So he says, be open to that transformation. It takes place within. But if you try to provoke it, make it happen, a conflict will begin in your heart that will leave you wounded and hurt. So simply open your heart. Let the transformation start taking place when life considers it the right moment. When life considers it the right moment. We have growing pains. Sometimes we see the darkness. But you know, when things are the darkest, that's when the light potentially is the brightest. So if we can face the darkness, we can hear God saying, let there be light. And that's the Shekinah, the light within. So could we open to that light within? Just by touching it. Just a willingness. You could tell that to your little girl as she grows up. Things will get dark. They'll get kind of scary. But if you just go within, you can find that light. Her little girl, Maddie, would go running up the aisle on Sundays. She knew the light when she was little. And then you can forget it when you grow up because you get caught up in the thoughts of the world. So remember what you knew when you were little. He says, the birds know how to fly. So to love is written in a man's soul. A love as big as an ocean. A love which can cover everything, he's telling this young individual. He says, man has only to throw himself into the tides of life with an open heart, and his own nature will do the rest. Our willingness to surrender to this life will then show us where we're blocked, where what will expand us. And then the question is, do you trust life? Can you say that life is here for me? Huh. And then when life gets kind of uncomfortable, can we not let it bring us down, but can we let it be a course correction for us to bring even more light in? And then to forgive the past and strangely bless it because it brought us to this place. Well, then you're in a co-creative way with the universe. Lastly, he says to this young man, it is love that will bring about the transformation within your soul. And with it will come the transformation of the world. So it has to start with transforming your soul, to know yourself as a being of soul. There's a wonderful book that's made out of wonderful essays. I'm thinking of teaching it again. It's called The Handbook for the Soul. So what if we're here to tend our soul, that invisible part of us, that knowing, that web of knowing, the net of Indra that we're all a part of? And you know, when the awakened one meets another awakened one, we begin to play in that realm, and we're not separate. Lastly, he says, when a human being finds this love and reveals it, the whole universe shudders in its splendor. When you discover this love and you let it reveal itself as you, through you, for you, it will change the whole world. And then you hear Jesus say, when two or more are gathered in my name, which is his nature, the nature of the light emerging, well, then I am potentiated. So what if that's the beauty of the Sangha? We come together in the true nature, not as individuals wanting to have a leader, but in fact, the leader falls away and we become a gaggle a gaggle of light beings. Anna Helprin had a creative thing. It was called collective creativity. And this emerged from her ministry. And what she learned, and she was a dance teacher, if you had one dancer doing a dance, it was one thing. But if you brought a whole room filled with people and you invited them to explore the creative process through movement, you had a thing called collective creativity. They would inspire each other and something greater would emerge, not from an individual, but the collective movement, because we're all connected in that web of creativity. And so the invitation is more and more to get out of the me that thinks he has answers and to begin to play in a field that is intelligent, a field that is creative, a field that is imaginative. You know, I love that poster in the men's room. It says Albert Einstein, big old Albert Einstein, his head, saying, "I don't want to know what man thinks. I want to know what God thinks." Now, that's not just said flippantly. Could we tap into that web of intelligence that is not bound by concept and conclusion and belief system? I believe, I truly know that it's possible. And you get to this place where you love saying, "I don't have an answer for you, Tia." Isn't that a great place to be? Then something can emerge, not from the local self, from the conditioned mind that wants to create a conclusion and an outcome. Then you have no attachment to the outcome, and you're not the doer. You've surrendered to something that is doing you. Well, what would life look like? Well, I would suggest to you that you'd be free. You wouldn't be bound by what it should look like. You'd be curious as to about what does it want to show me at this stage. Can I be teachable and open, Miss Nancy, to see the mystery and to be a voice for that, a voice for this unfolding that is so intimate and yet so mysterious? It gets more mysterious with every day. Watch Nova sometime. It'll blow your mind. And you know what's so funny? Science is taking us to the great mystery. Richard Rohr, he's this enlightened Franciscan monk, and he does a lot of talking to scientific communities. And he said, "I find most of the mystics are among our scientists, the quantum physicists, because they recognize the mystery of the universe and how it's all part of the one. They talk about this field of love that we all share. They don't have sin. They don't have judgment. They don't have wrath or envy. They just have this web of knowing that's emerging through its creation, and we're that creation." So with that simple seed idea, how are we going to relate to it? There's the question again. How are we going to relate to this field of knowing, to this web of intelligence? And remember, this intelligence doesn't have knowledge per se. It has gnosis. Jesus says the very first logian in the Gospel of Thomas is like the slap in the face. He says, in all your seeking, he says, seek until you find. And he says, and when you find, you will be greatly disturbed. And when you're greatly disturbed, you'll be filled with wonder and awe. And when you're filled with wonder and awe, you will have dominion over your world. Let those who have ears to hear, hear. So in other words, stop identifying as the seeker and start identifying as the sought. This thing is wanting to wake up within you. Stop chasing after it. And he says, and when you do, you'll be greatly disturbed. Why are you disturbed? Because it was there all along, Seamus. It was right there from the time you were a little boy to the time you're now. It's been right there. Oh my God, it's been right there, and I've been chasing after it, seeking it out there. And then he says, and then you'll be filled with wonder and awe. Because, oh my God, the intelligence of the universe, the love of the universe is flowing in me, and you will have dominion over your world. In other words, you'll be able to choose you this day who you will serve, the local neurotic self, the finite self that wails and suffers. Are you going to serve this infinite presence that lies stretched in smiling repose that's always been there, Paula? Little Maddie knew it when she was little. Mom and Dad forgot it. Could we look at the young ones who are still there, who are in that alive place of the presence, without concepts and belief systems? They're not contaminated. They're pure, unconditional love revealing itself. So could we take communion with the ones? They become our teachers. And then you hear Jesus again. You must be like a child if you would enter the kingdom. He's not saying you need to get young again, Jan. He's saying you need to have that innocence and that freshness to see God in a penguin. And so I'm going to, Jean, will you give us a ring on the mindfulness bell? I'm going to take us into a little meditation with my happy penguin here. I love the bell. I have bells all around my garden. They're called process bells. And so when I walk down a path, I ring a bell and I stop and I go within. And then I take another turn in the garden and there's a bell hanging from the tree and I ring the bell, ding, and I stop and I listen. And then oftentimes I open to feel the love that's coming from all the many life forms in the garden. The flowers. Emerson said the earth laughs in flowers. So I feel the laughter of the flowers. And lately I've been seeing the hummingbirds drinking from the Salvia guaranetica, and the bumblebees in the sunflowers, just getting drunk on the nectar of the sunflowers, and how they all are part of this space of sacredness unfolding, creating a vibrational field of belonging, that we're all in the garden. And then we go back to the Garden of Eden, which was a consciousness of bliss. And that's the metaphor again. Originally, when we started this whole journey, it was all sacred. We were in a consciousness of bliss. And we only fell from grace when we ate from the tree of good and evil. Then we began to think in terms of bad and good and right and wrong, evil and you know what. And then we can't be in the garden anymore, because the garden symbolizes consciousness of harmony and balance and peace. So this Sunday, I'm going to take you back into the garden of your soul, where you get to nurture the soil of your soul so that it's open and teachable and it can receive enlightened ideas as they want to take root and begin to grow and flower as your field of awareness, knowing that all we need is the intention to serve this beloved presence. I love to say, beloved, this life belongs to you, do with it as you will. And in that declaration, instead of ordering it around, telling it what I want, I invite that loving presence to use this life as an instrument for its grace, for its freedom, for its power. And then I ask the question, how might I serve at the highest level? And then through lowly listening, I live life one step at a time, one breath at a time, knowing that it will be shown. So feeling that connection to that web of knowing within your heart, I invite you to place your hands on your heart chakra and say to this emergent evolution within you, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
I love you.
You are the web of knowing flowering in my soul.
Living in the questions.
Discovering the mystery.
Saying yes a thousand times yes.
This life belongs to you, beloved. Celebrate it. Delight in it. And use me.
I stand for you.
And here I'll abide.
As you show me
what I must do.
With cheerful expectancy,
I embrace the next moment.
With gratitude and playfulness.
And so it is.
So thank you, my beloveds. It's always a joy.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.